This episode of The Drunken Odyssey is brought to you by Scribophile, an online community with thousands of serious writers working in every conceivable genre. If you're eager to improve your own work and network with others, Scribophile is for you. Scribophile has educational tutorials, exciting forums, and most importantly, the ability to exchange in-depth critiques with other writers, using a karma system that keeps the exchange fair and equal. What is most exciting to me is that Scribophile allows writers to critique novel chapters, which is not something a writer can be guaranteed to experience in an MFA program. A basic account is free and grants you all the features, but upgrading to a premium account allows you to gain access to posting numerous works at once, requires no additional karma points to enter contests and other special features for only $9 a month or $65 a year. That's a lot less than a Netflix subscription. Listeners of The Drunken Odyssey will receive a 20% discount on top of those already low rates. Check out this week's show notes for details.
Hello, John King. This is Denise Duhamel wishing The Drunken Odyssey a very happy 8th birthday. Congratulations.
Hey, this is Jared Silvia just calling to say happy 800th birthday to The Drunken Odyssey. John, when you appeared in this dimensional plane as a powerful time wizard, no one expected that you would wield that terrific power to host a literary podcast, but here we are 800 years later, and I think it's just tremendous. So I wanted to say happy 800th birthday to The Drunken Odyssey, and I raise my glass to 800 more.
This is Todd Pierce. A very happy anniversary to the world's greatest creative writing podcast as it turns 8 in its Homeric journey towards all those areas of interest we think of as home. And as long as we're on the subject of the podcast namesake, Dr. King, you have no possibility of escape from your duties as host because, as I'm sure Homer would tell you, in naming your podcast after the Odyssey, you've signed up for at least a 10-year wandering journey. Or if you include the war, 20. And in the invitation, I was encouraged to use blue language, which I'm assuming is a reference to Picasso's Blue Period. So I'll leave you with the words of Pablo, where he says, "It takes a long time for a person to become young," which I think is perfect for the nautical strains of The Drunken Odyssey, where through the writing life, the craft of storytelling and poetry, and the subjects of comics, films, and pop culture, each week, it explores the nuances of art in its many forms that we might not have noticed on our own.
Hey, John. Jeff Benz here. Hey, I just wanted to wish you a happy birthday for the Drunken Odyssey podcast. Love, love, love it. I have been on it. Love listening to it. I know so many other people feel that way, too. You've done just a fabulous job with it, and I look forward to many more happy years of listening to The Drunken Odyssey. So, hey, great man. Appreciate all you do.
Hey, this is Misty. I'm just calling to say happy 8th birthday to The Drunken Odyssey. It is always a pleasure listening, and I appreciate all of the hard work that goes into making such an incredible podcast. If I could give one piece of advice to any writer, it would be always use a fucking Oxford comma.
The change in the weather is taken to be a good sign, a blessing. I would tell these people if I could. Signs are always either coincidences or something stamped onto memories in hindsight. Blessings never have merit.
Welcome to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life.
Tell us, muse, about a man whose mind and career has careened far and wide and upside down, whose computers are seared with crimes against grammar, whose typographical aggressions are legion, whose words flow into the very mouth of time, and more than a few bottles. A man who actually owns a typewriter, and perhaps even a soul.
And now, your host, John King.
Welcome, my friends, to episode 424 of the World's Greatest Writing Podcast. I am John King and not one of my robot duplicates. And this is the episode that commemorates the Drunken Odyssey's 8th birthday. That doesn't quite make this a dinosaur as podcasts go, but yeah, we're old. Oh, today's guest is novelist Ronan Ryan. He spent 3 months writing as a resident of the Kerouac House, just, 7 miles from my house. But because of the COVID-19 pandemic, our conversation had to be transatlantic. If you would like to leave your birthday wishes for the Drunken Odyssey, well, you know, I remember my friend Jennifer, and for her, birthdays were like a month-long celebration. Anyway, if you want to send a voice memo to thedrunkenodyssey@gmail.com, I will try and include it in next week's show. I had a great conversation with Ronan, so I think I'm going to shut up and get out of the way. Though the next voice you hear will be mine.
And now, the interview of the day.
Ronan Ryan is the author of the novel The Fractured Life of Jimmy Dice, which tells the story of the Diaz family of Ireland, mostly through the frame of the ill-fortuned Jimmy Diaz and witnessed by the perspective of the ghost of Jimmy's even more ill-fortuned twin. This novel depicts the interdependence of human experience in ways that harken back to Honoré de Balzac's The Human Comedy and James Joyce's Dublin, as seen in Dubliners, especially The Dead and Ulysses, but with a style that is accessible, yet surprising and so addictive. Ryan also was the Kerouac House resident for 2020, and yet this is the first time we're going to get to have a lengthy conversation. Thank you so much, Ronan.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
You just got done making the trip back to Ireland after the closest we got, because I missed the potluck before the orders to stay away came down. Mm-hmm. Right, we talked 15 feet apart for about 10 minutes.
Sure.
For loose lips. So what was your travel back home like? It seemed rather spectral.
It was really, really strange. So I think it took me like 21 hours from the time I left the Kerouac House to set foot in my flat in Dublin. And I was wearing a mask for that length of time, only taking it off to have a sip of water or to have a small amount to eat. And like it was 3 flights in 4 airports. And I'd say the first flight was maybe at like 40% capacity. The second flight, the big one, was for like 10%. And the final one was like maybe 33%. It was very, very weird. Some people, because you know how to wear a mask, were also just going full costume. You know, so like I saw, you know, Spider-Man walking around the airport and then I can't sleep on flights anyway, but I definitely couldn't sleep wearing a mask. So like I was awake all that time, and it's more exhausting even than it normally would be, because you're just hyper vigilant of your body space and you're trying not to touch your eyes. And And I discovered, like, in the last few hours, I really wanted to touch my eyes, because I, you know, they kind of get bloodshot over a lot of flying. And when I would yawn, my eyes would get kind of a bit teary. And if I could just rub my eyes, that'd be perfect. But because I couldn't, they started to sting. And it was.
Well, just the very thought.
Kind of messy.
That you're forbidden, like, you cannot touch your nose. And you're like, fine. Mm. And it's like, no, you cannot touch your nose. And you're like, well, now I want to touch my nose. Wait, that's. Now I can feel the itch. Wait, the itch. Your novel is an exquisite accomplishment, or to put it more accurately, it was really enjoyable to read.
Thank you.
Which I think is the award writers want most, is just, yeah, that other people, you know.
Sure.
And, you know, it's a little bit on the longer side, which means the reader really has to commit. And, you know, I think that you give a lot back to the reader. And in some ways, I don't know if you agree with the assessment I made in my introduction, but this book, you were really at trying to tell the story of a family. And that's a really difficult thing to accomplish, especially with traditional storytelling, which says, okay, you've got your protagonist and the protagonist needs a goal. And, you know, it's one of the things that literary fiction can do, is maybe subvert that very direct, heroic example of telling a story. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the ways that you learned to approach the book as a writer and the way that you determined how to try and get so many different points of view. And it jumps around in time some in ways where I think it was around page 75 where I'm like, oh, I kind of see what this is doing now. Like, okay, none of this is random. This isn't just cleverness. That this is building towards something, that these trauma points in the life of this family. There are plenty of pleasures to be, you know, read in the book, even though a lot of it is depicting a life I would not want to lead. Let's put it that way. So I wonder if you could talk about just the way that you conceived of the structure of the book and the way that you probably discovered that you wanted to tell the story of a whole family in ways that would go beyond, you know, much more textured way. This the classical, you know, protagonist. Okay, let's just, what does that person want and do they get it or not?
I tend to have like a fairly inefficient writing process. So like I have to write a ton of material to then kind of whittle it down to a book. So like I certainly wrote double the amount of pages that end up in the book. And I think my imagination does tend to sprawl a bit. But yeah, with the family stuff, I, on one level, I just wanted, like, I'm trying to say something that, well, this is kind of how life is. And life is kind of, to me, seems bursting with story all the time. And as so many people to it, so that if you're trying to get across what it's like to journey through life, you have all these people walking similar paths, even if you're not aware of it. And the story is told by the dead twin telling Jimmy's story, but there's a conscious aspect of I wanted all of the characters in a way to twin each other, you know, that they were all kind of mirrors to each other. But I also wanted them not to be good communicators with each other. So I like the idea that that, you know, that Jimmy wasn't really fully aware of the level of interior lives of the people around him. I think, say, like with our grandparents, it's very hard to imagine them as young people, you know, and it's hard to take that step. And it's a bit easier with parents, but I wanted that multi-generational thing to just show that there's a life beyond the central character, but the identities of the people around him also inform his identity. And there's a big legacy element, like different characters carry different legacies of the older generations too. And then just the way I tend to approach anything fiction-wise is that I think about someone who's a certain way in a certain moment of their life, like they have some kind of notable thing they do with their behavior. And then as I start to write, I need to work in both directions. So like I start working backwards to figure out what made them this way, or are they really formative experiences? I put them in situations to test, can they change? So for me, when I introduce any character, I then end up writing all this backstory. You know, like there's characters who probably have one line of dialogue in the novel that I actually wrote five pages of backstory to write the one line of dialogue. So eventually I managed to kind of contain it.
So hypothetically, you could make a new book out of what got cut out of this book.
Yeah. I think there's, you know, something too, like there's an old adage that even supporting characters, they should feel like the main character in their own novel. And
they weren't just hanging with out all waiting of the to be helpful.
Yeah. So like with all of the characters, I could have kept writing about them. You know, I've known writers who are pretty misanthropic, and I find that kind of baffling, because to me, one of the reasons to write is because you're fascinated with people and you want to understand what makes them tick and you want to spend time with them.
So are you comfortable with generating so much material? I imagine a lot of that has to do with the faith that you will discover the book that you need as you produce this work, and that you're kind of, I don't know, digging around in the dirt, just saying, okay, what, you know, where's the good stuff here?
Yeah, you know, like things like I'm not like a spiritual person in terms of beliefs, like I'm not religious or anything, but I do find writing a novel is kind of spiritual, because there's a spiritual aspect in that you are taking this leap of faith that if you keep writing, the things you need will emerge. And like E.L. Doctorow had this line about how that, you know, like he would kind of say this again and again in interviews, how like it's like a car with the headlights on going through a fog, and you can only see as far as a fog. Like I did certainly have images and things that I was trying to get to. And I had a rough idea of how I wanted to, where I wanted to end up. And even though I write in this sprawling way, I actually tend to have a certain amount of architecture and scaffolding in that. I knew, like, the book is divided into parts. I knew how many parts there would be. I had a pretty good idea of how many chapters there would be. And then it was kind of work within that framework. It was just an issue of, I would say I had to write a 5-page chapter and I would write a 20-page chapter. So I wouldn't recommend that anyone writes the way I write it, but yeah.
Well, I think that statement is the kind of corrective needed to younger writers or inexperienced writers who see the kind of work that you're doing. You know, when David Foster Wallace first became big, everyone tried to mimic him. And when Quentin Tarantino, Pulp Fiction, made everyone want to tell stories that way, and seldom were the results anywhere near as good as what Tarantino could do because of what you are doing with this book, it sounds like, which is, yes, it's breaking a lot of rules, but you're breaking them in very precise ways towards very precise ends. And that rather than being less preoccupied with the structure than, say, a traditional story, it seems like you are maybe even more preoccupied or maybe just occupied with the structure, in that the structure really had to accomplish what you wanted it to accomplish so that it wouldn't be random.
It's helpful to put certain limits in place and kind of have walls up in place so that you have to be kind of creative within confines. Like, often with each character, I would, like, I had a very strong sense of who each person was, and they couldn't deviate from that to kind of, you know, fit the plot. And there's certain things I would have been convenient ways for the story to go that I had a rule in place, so, well, it can't go that way. And sometimes I was even just, don't follow your first instinct, but go at your second, you know, because that can be something a bit more interesting. And maybe the obvious place to take something isn't the way to do it. I tend to be pretty rigorous in that. I feel like I have to fully explore the world I'm writing about, and I won't not try and write something because it's too challenging or I don't know enough about it. I'll always kind of bite off more than I can chew and then just try and figure out how to swallow it. You know?
Well, I think some of what you're talking about is the difference between literary writers and maybe genre writers. And it's not to say that there aren't great genre writers, but going with your second instinct, like, the first thing that pops into your mind might also be the first thing that pops into the reader's mind, in which case you're not giving the reader enough of a surprising experience if the reader can go, oh, and this is probably going to happen next, and there it is.
Yeah, definitely. Like, you always, you know, you have to be aware of people's expectations, and it's useful whenever you can kind of subvert it and just kind of take a road less traveled. I think readers appreciate it. And, you know, you're like, whenever a reader comes to a book, they come to it with the baggage of everything they've ever read and everything they've ever watched and so on. And you're always writing with the history of how things tend to go in mind. And it's just not very interesting if you kind of go for the obvious things.
And yet, in subverting expectations, it still has to be true to the character, so that it can't just be any old subversion. Like, no, it has to be the right subversion. I mean, I think of Aristotle's sense of the way plots should work out. And he goes, in retrospect, it should seem like there was no other way it could have happened, but it needs to be really surprising when you see it for the first time.
Sure. And, like, I'm a big believer that, you know, the decisions you make on the page, that they have to feel earned. And, you know, like, whatever I'm kind of interested in thematically, I feel like I have to write in the opposite direction too. You know, so you need that kind of constant contrast. One of the reasons I have a book populated with people who communicate badly was that I was really interested in intimacy. And the way to, you know, to my mind, the way you write an intimate novel is not write a novel in which everyone is, you know, has easy access to intimacy all the time. You actually try and deny them as much as possible so that when you have moments of connection, they hit a bit harder. And similarly, I was interested in kind of tenderness, so I wrote a very violent novel, you know. And again, I think when you've moments of tenderness, they hit more when you've had kind of all this kind of violence preceding it.
And somehow that seems Irish to me. And I don't know. I guess I'm asking you, can you verify my essentialist Irish notion? But in some ways, my own family being Irish, like I kind of recognize some of my family in the Diaz family, even though the Diaz family is, you know, like the definite Latin strain.
Yeah, well, I think there's definitely a thing in the like Irish character of being drawn to suffering and being almost happier when there's a certain amount of suffering happening. You know, there is a morbid element to the novel I've written, but then at the same time, like I do enjoy gallows humor and morbid humor, and when you write towards darkness, there's actually an opportunity to make things funny in places, and there's a little victory in getting a moment of humor in kind of bleak times. I like dark books, but I almost don't trust a book if there's no humor running through it, because it just seems like it's missing some aspect of this inevitability of just what life is like.
I remember at some point in the 90s, I thought, I kind of like Marilyn Manson. I respect the music, but Rob Zombie seems like way more fun.
Sure,
because you know, like they both love to be, you know, these sort of horrible monster creatures on stage, but one of them was having fun and the other one was deadly earnest. And, you know, sure. I would rather hang out with a person who can laugh.
Yeah. And I think, you know, humor as well, it can be a way to make people kind of question themselves. If you find something funny that you feel like it shouldn't be funny, that can be kind of interesting. You know, like I think it's a great victory of say like Lolita, that it's a very funny book and you read it and you go, what's wrong with me to find this funny? But like it's intended to be funny, but it's
but the audience
it leads to an element of self-examination. It increases the introspection for the reader as well.
So at what point did the narrative point of view arrive? Because I presume that wasn't like a step one decision that you made, that this dead twin would end up being either the narrator or at least the narrator controlling the direction of the narrative focus.
I feel like I did in a lot of ways begin with that. Like I was interested in, like I was conscious that in my own life that I always feel this duality of I'm the person in the moment feeling everything, having a physical experience of the world and an emotional experience, and it's very intense. And then I'm also the person who's at a remove watching things, like the constant observer. And I think everyone has that to some degree. I think writers probably have it a bit more. But I thought I could get at something about what it is to kind of experience the world just by having that from the start. You know, and also like there is like a Horace Walpole, if I'm saying his name correctly, quote that to someone who's primarily a feeler, the world is tragic. To someone who's primarily a thinker, the world is comedic. So I was interested in having a main character who really feels quite intensely, and then limiting the narrator to being pure thought. Even though in practice, the narrator was quite emotional too, because the narrator couldn't not feel what it was, you know, writing about or the story it was telling.
The book is separated into kind of two halves. The first half being intensely about the family and covering a lot of the tragic trajectory of their story, and moving around in time in ways that are very precise, but, you know, do require from the reader these mental adjustments. Like, okay, now we're going to watch the grandfather as a young man in the Spanish Civil War, where he should not really have been. And then the second half is more about Jimmy's love life, in which the family kind of takes this, kind of recedes in the story, and then comes back in a way that makes the novel feel really complete at the end, which is sneaky because you made us think like the family story was kind of over at this point, and it's nope, it's coming back. So I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the decision to break it up into these two halves and, you know, where the momentum for that came from.
I wanted to kind of give you the course of someone's life in which you get in all the really key formative experiences and the real kind of identity blocks. And I think, you know, part of it is like when you're growing up, your family is kind of a much bigger part of your life. And then, you know, as you get older, you are on your own more. And by introducing kind of a love interest and then having the love story kind of take over the book for a while, I think in part that is a way to, you know, emphasize what it's like to be really in love and to have it kind of swallow up things. But then there's also an element of life goes on for everyone, and everyone is still there and everyone's still on this kind of this journey. And you can't, even if you have these kind of shattering life experiences, the rest of your life doesn't go away. You know, those influences still come back and they're part of that complete journey of who you are as a person. So it felt like a natural thing that happened within the storytelling, you know, it made sense and it facilitated what I was trying to write about. But so it was probably both. There was a conscious element to it, but also there was an element of just following what's the part of the story I'm really obsessed with right now, and what is, you know, where's the character's fixations right now.
So it seems like, yeah, there's two parts of your mind that have to be engaged. There's the part that's thinking, where's this going? How is this going to be useful? And then there's the part that's just following the scent of, no, let's just keep feeding this part.
Sure. Yeah, you know, and like, you know, there's also an intellectual part of like writing, obviously, and that's inescapable. But I do try and write, you know, kind of heart first. And I was consciously writing something as earnest as I could make it. You know, like I think when I'm writing earlier drafts of stuff, I've probably a tendency to, I can write at times in a kind of a flippant way, but in editing, I try and get rid of all of that. I didn't want to write something that was kind of hugely ironic or anything. I wanted to write something that was kind of heart on sleeve and to err on the side of too much emotion than kind of not enough.
Well, would you be interested in hearing when I fell in love with the book?
Sure, please.
So there's this, okay. So one of the children of the Diaz family was killed in an automobile accident. And so the family goes to the races, and the daughter who was there when her brother was struck by the car ends up just urinating in public. And the mother has mental health issues, and we think, okay, we can kind of see this horrible torch is being passed from the mother to the daughter. And then as the scene keeps going, because of the narrator who can move as this sort of omniscient creeper, let's put it that way.
Sure.
We find out, oh, this isn't random, but she saw the driver of the car at the races. And it was at that point that I felt like this was a world I needed to live in for a while. So
thank you.
I don't know. The formalist in me likes to like pinpoint these moments where, you know, this is where a good book comes alive, where I'm like, oh, I really trust this guy now to take me far. And then there, you know, also when looking at student manuscripts and whatnot, yeah, there are times where I'm like, okay, here's where it goes off the rails here.
Sure.
Yeah, that's not really a question. That's just me observing these connections because, you know, I'm a Joyce scholar, and occasionally I come across students who are like, oh no, I'm going to write like this because, and then there is this example, and I'm like, yes, but Ezra Pound could not be published today unless he changed his style. So it seems to me like you're doing a lot of what Joyce did, but you're using different tools to get those effects in ways that feel very contemporary and don't feel like we're running this avant-garde slalom.
Sure. Well, like it was very important to me to like, if I'm using some kind of unusual technique or telling the story from a strange perspective, like I was never doing it as a exercise. You know, I was never like, I want metafictional aspects and I want to do some postmodern thing or whatever.
Look at what I could do.
To me, it was just the way, the best, like I tried to tell the story the best way I could. And when like there are these kind of unusual like aspects of how the story is being told, it's there because I thought I could go deeper or more heartfelt by doing it, that I could get at more about just my sense of what it is to be alive. Like one of the problems with a lot of storytelling is that it all makes too much sense. You know, characters are on their arcs and the cause and effect is so, it feels like such a conscious pattern. Whereas life to me is this kind of constant chaos and constant strangeness, you know. And by having this ghostly narrator, having that layer on the story, it just makes it all more strange. But that's not for the sake of making more strange. It's because I'm trying to say, well, look, life feels as strange. It feels like there's more going on than there may be going on. And yeah.
Well, as bizarre as it may sound, having this ghostly narrator allows the story to be more realistic.
Sure. Yeah. I was kind of going for that, you know, at least maybe not in a scientifically realistic way, but just in an emotionally realistic way. And then it's a useful counterpoint to Jimmy, who is having parts of his identity stripped from him through the story, to then have that contrast with the twin who doesn't even have some of those basic building blocks of identity that Jimmy has. So I'm kind of interested in how things can always be worse too. And then just that kind of contrast between what, you know, what different characters have and what other characters near them don't have. It kind of makes it a bit more, it makes it kind of pop a bit more. It makes it a bit more vivid if you have the contrast.
Jimmy loses things emotionally and psychologically, but he also loses parts of his body physically.
Yeah, sure.
And there's one passage I've marked that I think I'll read. And so this is chapter 7, The Importance of Flesh and Bone, April 1988. That's Seb Quinn sitting upside down on an armchair in the Diaz living room. It's not the scruffy one matching the 3-seater couch. Both are blue-gray, freckled with black dots. No, it's the good, creaking leather one. Dad's chair. Seb's 7-year-old feet extend to the chair's apex, gravity pulling on his shoelace loops and on his turquoise tracksuit bottoms, revealing his hairless forelegs. His arms and head droop off the seat, his mouth agape, the heavy rush of blood to a skull is pleasant. His perspective doesn't seem all that untenable. The beige carpet has become a ceiling, showing no indication of jettisoning the furniture to the white floor. Only the inverted door looks properly confused. He's enjoying himself, but needs more. Jimmy, I'm so bored. Shut up, I'm almost done, Jimmy says. This without looking up from the Transformers comic he's reading while lying on the couch. Until the Decepticons are defeated, he feels justified in ignoring Seb. And, you know, in so many of the themes of the book are at play here in such a playful scene. You know, for me, this is the way themes should work, which is only on rereading should it ever seem clear that this is dealing with the themes of the book. The Decepticons and Transformers and the absurd physicality of them just as characters, but the analogs to human beings isn't necessarily that different than we might think.
Sure. I'm kind of interested in just what moments become really memorable to us. Like with the kids stuff, it's kind of like it's interesting to me, just when I think back to my own childhood, there'd be like, you know, objects like couches and different things that I have this real kind of tangible memory of how they felt and all that. And I find it interesting how if we had a CV of our life and a list of our experiences, that often the ones that are more prominent, they wouldn't have affected as much sometimes as these really minor things that really stuck with us, you know, and like small little slights or small embarrassments. So, yes. Yeah, so I was trying to find just moments that just kind of the characters may not have known it at the time, but this is something that will kind of stick with them forever. I'm just saying as well as well, you know, we all have bodies and the physicality of life is this kind of unavoidable part. So I was kind of throwing people around couches and stuff.
Well, there's that delightful kid thing, like, okay, I know there's a standard use for this, but we shouldn't dwell on that too long. If I'm allowed to experiment. And also, yeah, if he's sitting upside down for a while, what is it going to take for him not to be bored?
Sure.
Which maybe indicates some of the trouble that is directly going to be on the way. So can you talk about what made you want to be a creative writer?
There are lots of things. The big one was that when I was 19, my closest friend died. She was a French woman. She died in Paris. And with our friendship, it had been the majority of time we spent together was just the two of us. And I became a bit worried that I would begin to forget some of the memories over time. And also, I didn't quite have the tools at the time to grieve properly or to really express how I was feeling. So on the day that would have been her 21st birthday, which was almost a year after she died, I went to a cafe in Dublin and I thought, well, I'll sit down, I'll write like 5 pages and I'll have this kind of record for myself of the friendship. And one writing session became like more than 30, and like over 6 months I ended up writing more than 200 pages, maybe 250 pages, just a record of our entire friendship. And it was such a massive kind of relief to just get that off my chest and to write in a completely uninhibited way, because it wasn't for a reader. And so after I had finished that, I was kind of at a loose end. So I thought, well, why not try and write a novel? And at that point, I wasn't even trying to write a good novel. I was just like, you know, I seem to be able to write a long piece of work, so I'll write a bad novel. And then as I was writing that, it occurred to me that, you know, I'd really like to publish a book that was dedicated to my friend. So after I finished the bad novel, I started writing a better novel, and there were a few different things, but eventually I finished the book that I was able to dedicate to my friend. So yeah, like it's certainly for me, becoming a writer came out of loss. But once I found it, I knew very quickly I want to spend the rest of my life doing this. And it did feel like it just kind of unlocked something from me. And I felt very early on, like early on, I felt I'd rather spend my life failing at being a writer than succeeding at anything else. And I knew that life was short and that it can get cut short very quickly. So I had a sense like, well, why not just go for what you want to do in life? So I approached the whole thing in a very intense, obsessive way, which you probably, any writer probably has to do. It all came out of that.
So was the character Nicole inspired by that experience?
There's no character that is my friend and Laura, and I'm not Jimmy. But at the same time, all of the characters are informed by the people I've known. And if I hadn't known my friend and Laura, well, like I don't know, I probably wouldn't have become a writer, but I would have written a completely different book if I had accidentally become a writer. So certainly Nicole and other characters wouldn't be written the way they are without her. But certainly the character isn't Nicole.
Yeah, I think my two main impulses as a writer, or at least as a creative writer, is I want to at least try and imagine a better fucking world than the one we live in, even if it's only a little better. And I also want to hold on to the things that make me want to live in this world.
Sure. Yeah, no, like I wanted to write a really life-affirming book, you know. And it's a book in which, you know, it's kind of just like there's so much tragedy and trauma. But I kind of felt like you have to acknowledge that to say what you think is kind of good about life. And it's kind of through loss that we realize what's really precious and what's really worth holding on to. So if I read a book that's all, you know, happiness and light, I don't find that life affirming. I actually find that kind of depressing because it seems so unreal to me. So like I do find, like I've certainly read dark books and, you know, felt so much kind of stronger and noticing more things around me because of it. I, like there was like a a Sartre quote. I think it was Sartre, where he was saying that, you know, like every book, and I'm going to paraphrase him pretty badly, but every book is an optimistic act, because even if you're writing about something that's kind of relentlessly, you know, bad, you're saying it can be understood, or an attempt can be made to understand it. You know, it can be faced. Whereas, so like, it's very important to me that I feel I should be willing to write about anything. If there's something that happens in life, no matter how kind of ugly or complicated or sad it is, I should be willing to stare it down and wrestle with it and write about it. And that's a way of walking like towards life as opposed to walking away from it.
And as you're writing these reminiscences of your friend and trying to chronicle the friendship, at some point, was there pleasure taken in just the act of writing itself? Like, I think I got it. I think I got it close. And, you know, like, there's pleasure in using the words, even if I am writing about something that's making me sad, but I also, you know, need to remember.
Yeah, like I would say, like, at that point, I didn't care what a good sentence was. You know, I was just getting things down. But I've always found that when the writing is going well, it feels euphoric. And I would distinguish between, say, it being euphoric as opposed to being joyful. I feel it's more euphoric than joyful, in that it feels a bit manic. The joy seems like a less kind of complicated emotion. Yeah, you know, like I do find writing really euphoric when it's going well. I find writing more emotional than life in a lot of ways, you know. When I'm living life, and when anyone is going about living life, you can't just be this outpouring of every emotion you feel. You tailor it to what's happening around you, and you express it with you're holding things back, and or you're just calibrating it for the people around you. But when I sit down to write, I never feel more present. I never feel more myself. And I never put any check on how much I'm going to explore an emotion. And I can't write like a sad scene without feeling sad while I'm writing it. I can't, if I write something funny, I'm amusing myself. So yeah, you know, it's all very intense, but I really love doing it. And I don't look back at any writing session I've ever had wishing I'd spent time doing anything else. It always seems like the greatest way to spend time, you know, and challenging and incredibly frustrating. Like, nothing is more frustrating to me than writing, in lots of ways, but it's always worth it for the moments when you're feeling something really intensely. And I understand things more when I write about them. I discover what I think about something. I'm constantly surprising myself when I'm writing. So I just find that it's a way of testing who you are. It's a way of moving forward as a person.
It's a way of understanding the past and maybe finding some hope that you can work towards a future that isn't hopeless.
Yeah, no, definitely. You know, as I said, it's a way of saying, look, it's all worth it. Later, as I was writing, I certainly cared more about, I wanted to write better sentences and stuff. But you're trying to get at something that just feels kind of real and heartfelt all the time.
But I'm guessing maybe the sentences you didn't care about at the time weren't terrible.
I suspect that they were really terrible. Like, I think it took me a long time to learn how to write a clean sentence where each of the words in the sentence are doing some work. And then there's probably a point at which I was writing sentences that were probably too pretty. And now I'm very careful about scaling it back. I don't want a sentence in the book to take you out of the story. You know, I don't want "this is language" to be a distraction. The sentences and the language has to be a way into the novel. And what I want is that, you know, when people remember the novel, like, it's great if there's a passage that you know, they like, and if they like sentences, but I want them primarily to have a really visual memory of the story and to have had like an emotional experience in reading it. So certainly, yeah, a lot of sentences, I will pull them back or remove them, if even if it's a really nice sentence to look at if it doesn't enhance the emotional moment, and if it breaks the register on the page by just being too showy, it has to go.
The style needs to serve the story and not the ego of the writer.
Definitely.
And I think that's one of the dangers of choosing literature as your genre is learning how to write the not pretty sentence or use the unusual word just because you're in love with the word and it doesn't necessarily go there.
Everything has to be earned, you know, and like especially I think because I write in this kind of sprawling way where I write a lot of stuff and then I'm trying to make it smaller and kind of carve it down. When I'm doing the edits, I'm really like, well, does this need to be here? You know, if I take it out, is the story intact? Is it better? So I do pretty rigorously go through stuff and try and remove all the excess.
So one, I owe you a nature walk when you come back to Orlando, whenever that is, maybe 2 years from now. What was your experience like as a resident in the house? Normally, some residents like to not go out and engage publicly, and your options were kind of taken away from you.
Ideally, what I was looking for was a kind of a balance of I would get lots of work done, and I would also experience, you know, the city around me and the nature, and get to meet as many people as possible. But yeah, like I arrived on March 1st. From March 12th, I was in kind of proper lockdown, only leaving to do grocery runs. But it was a really really fantastic experience. The house was amazing. I was really into the writing I was doing, partly because it was an escapism from the world around me. But I think we're all learning something about ourselves at the moment, because, you know, a few months ago, if we were all told a pandemic is going to happen, our idea of how we would manage it would be quite different to how we actually do. So like there was a confidence in knowing that I could spend all this time in the house and I'm not cracking up. Like I learned it didn't get to me as much as I thought. And the thing is, like, writing always feels extremely social to me because I get so involved with the characters I'm writing about. You know, like if I've been writing for 3 hours, I feel like I've been having a long conversation. So I didn't feel, and when I'm reading as well, that also feels very social to me. So I didn't feel I was in as much isolation as I obviously was.
Well, and it takes some getting used to. At least for me, when I get the time to write, like a 3-4 hour stretch, I kind of need to remind myself, like, no, this is the best case scenario as a writer. Like, you could do this.
There was an opportunity that came from isolating, you know, and I was excited for what I was going to do with my time. Like one of the things that I discovered when I started writing for the first time was I feel like the moment I started writing was the moment in which I ceased to ever experience boredom. Because there's always things I want to write, there's things I want to read, there's things I want to experience. And like I just never get bored. Like all the time in the Kerouac house, I would have been quite happy to have had 36-hour days. You know, I wouldn't have had any trouble filling the time. So I'm just not someone who goes stir crazy with a lot of time in my hands. Like I wish I had more. And like it would have been nice to stay at the house even longer, but my temporary visitor status was up.
Well, that's the show for this week. I would like to thank Ronan Ryan and Scribophile. Don't forget to check out thedrunkenodyssey.com throughout the week for all kinds of great written content, including Comics Are Trying to Break Your Heart by Drew Barth, and The Curator of Schlock by Jeff Schuster. All right, gang. Until next time, put your ass in the chair, keep attacking those keys, and don't swallow the worm. Stay safe out there.
Dear listeners, this is your friend, Chris Booth. If you have enjoyed this program, which comes to you absolutely free, and are wondering what you might do to support this show, please, please, please write a review of the podcast on iTunes, comment on the website, and most of all, tell your friends. If you buy books online, please click on the Powell's link on the left-hand side of the website. doing so will grant this show a small commission on anything you purchase, at no expense at all to you, and help support both a wonderful podcast and a wonderful brick-and-mortar independent bookstore in Portland, Oregon. If you must use the services of the metastasizing mega-corporate empire Amazon.com, then there is a similar link to Amazon further down the page on the left-hand side. You fiends. Thank you for listening. I will now resume drinking. Ever yours, Christopher.
We're gonna need a blowtorch and some more peanut butter.
Sailor Jerry, only you understand me.
Thank you for listening to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life. This is your announcer, Lauren Butler.